Hello, and welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on. Don't forget the exciting recent addition to our membership system. We've now included in the Turkey Book Talk membership deal the archive of a whopping 231 reviews that I wrote for the Hurriyet Daily News until this summer. Those reviews sadly appear to have been deleted by HDN, but rather than let all that work just disappear, I've decided to give Turkey Book Talk members access to the archive of all of those reviews that I wrote over the course of 5 years. They cover a pretty diverse spread of subjects, from Turkish and international fiction and poetry to history, journalism, politics, the Middle East and Europe. Members get all the reviews packaged up and put into various categories, so the archive should be pretty easy to browse. If you sign up as a member, you'll receive that archive along with all the other extras that a Turkey Book Talk membership brings. That includes full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview, published on Turkey Book Talk via email as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 70 conversations and well over 200,000 words. And the archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Finally, members also get access to a very nice 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles, and they've kindly made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast so far, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. To become a member and to help us keep going, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, or of course by doing a quick Google search. As we post new episodes every 2 weeks, the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. And if you're not sure about it for yourself, why not consider signing up for a friend or colleague who may be interested? But now let's get cracking with our latest episode. In it, we hear from Begum Adalet, a visiting assistant professor at Cornell University and the author of Hotels and Highways, The Construction of Modernization Theory in Cold War Turkey, which is published by Stanford University Press. The book takes a close look at Turkey in the aftermath of the Second World War, and particularly in the 1950s, the start of its alliance with the United States at the advent of the Cold War. Turkey was the recipient of aid as part of the Truman Doctrine, knitting it into the Western alliance against the Soviet Union and reshaping its economic preferences, which had long-lasting effects. The 1950s was also an era when Turkey started to be put forward as a model for various other countries, particularly in the Middle East, often very simplistically. With recent turbulence in the US-Turkey relationship, this is a very good opportunity to look once again at this foundational era, and I started by asking Begum Adalet to reflect on the convenient timing of the publishing of her book.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of questions being asked, and I think there's a lot of commentary about how unprecedented this worsening of relationship between the two places seems. But of course, when we look closely, we know that, you know, during the 1960s, there had been a series of crises, the infamous Johnson letter on Cyprus, there's the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then the invasion of Cyprus. At that moment, we have a brief end of U.S. sale of American weapons to Turkey. There are talks of actually sanctions during the 1970s to halt opium poppy production, which is seen as related to kind of this opium epidemic that Nixon's worried about. And so, you know, there are precedents in terms of crises between Turkish-American relations. But my book looks at a period of beginnings of this kind of a romance between the two places, with the inclusion of Turkey as a beneficiary of the Marshall Plan, despite its not having participated in World War II at all, not having joined the Allies and until the last moment possible, and then a relationship that grows with a military alliance during the Korean War, and then Turkey's inclusion in NATO, Turkey very enthusiastically hosting U.S. military bases and nuclear missiles along its coasts, and then these sort of various programs and technical aid and expertise and exchange programs, etc., continuing over the years, starting with the Truman Doctrine and Marshall Plan, and then through various agencies, USAID, and over the years also, of course, U.S.-based foundations like Rockefeller and Ford also become very, very involved in as kind of private partnerships in furthering these kinds of programs. But today, again, it seems that with Erdogan using many opportunities, including the recent economic crisis, as a way of kind of, we can call it a posturing of anti-imperialist stance, blaming the U.S. as the root cause of a bunch of things, from the coup to what Erdogan sees as internal roots of terrorism to the recent crisis, it seems as though he gets to rehearse a number of kind of anti-U.S. rhetorics that have been used over the years, kind of using all that to his advantage for garnering domestic support. So it seems like a kind of interesting point where there are certain novelties in the relationship, but I also see echoes of earlier periods as well.
Now, the book focuses on this kind of very specific time at the start of the relationship, really, the kind of genesis, really, in the late 40s and the flourishing, really, in the 1950s with the start of the Cold War. And Turkey was really seen as being at the front line of the Cold War, had borders with the Soviet Union. So Turkey was seen strategically as being very important. It's a classic cliche about Turkey, you know, geographical importance and crucial strategic ally and all this. And it was because of this importance, it had a very crucial role in the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine, which was developed in 1948 by President Harry Truman. And that kind of aimed to bring Turkey and Greece under the wing of the Western Alliance. Also, Turkey joined NATO at this time. So just talk about where Turkey fit in at the time, the kind of role that it was given, and also the importance that your book looks at of modernization theory in this. Can you just kind of unpack like modernization theory and how that fit in with these ideas of the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine?
Yeah, I mean, Turkey's role in the kind of the larger scheme of things at this moment has to do with the strategic location, a strong NATO member, a military ally in a moment of kind of possible Soviet aggression. And Turkey plays, starting with the CHP membership, but then after the transition to the Democrat Party rule, a lot of the Turkish policymakers do a very good job of playing up some of these anxieties and starting with claims about Soviet aggression towards the Bosphorus and so forth. So there's that dimension of it. And then this is also a time when this thing called modernization theory is becoming very popular and prevalent, both in academic circles, but also a certain degree in official circles in the US. And basically, it's a very linear theory about what development ought to look like. And it's modeled after this kind of an idealized Anglo-American trope of a combination of all good things going together, like urbanization and industrialization and democracy and so on and so forth. But it's ultimately gets reflected in things like the Truman Doctrine or the Marshall Plan, which are in a way about kind of restructuring production and consumption patterns in Western Europe, but also in places like Greece and Turkey. And so modernization theory is this component of the ideological component, I suppose, of an offering of a US-based capitalistic model of development, of modernization, and the projects, the monies that come through things like the implementation of highways, support for the tourism industry, agricultural mechanization, I discuss in the book as types of the material manifestations of these theories about modernization, which are not at all purely theoretical, but are actually really concretely being worked out in these material sites at the same time as Turkey is also transitioning from a statist economy towards private economy. Private enterprises like the Hilton Corporation or manufacturers of mechanical equipment, tractors or highway building equipment, etc., also get involved in the simultaneous crafting and application of this modernization theory in Turkey in particular.
Now, perhaps the most symbolic aspect of all this was the kind of prioritizing of highway construction over railway construction. Railroad construction started in the late Ottoman Empire, and then it was really accelerated by the Republic of Turkey. The railroads were nationalized in 1924, and they became kind of symbols, really, of the republican landscape. But this started to change after the Second World War. Basically, in order to kind of secure American aid, the CHP in the single party era after the Second World War kind of started to abandon its kind of railway-led, state-owned industrialization policies in favor of agricultural growth, privatization, and highways. And this was really accelerated much further with the advent of the multi-party system and the coming to power of the Democrat Party in 1950. So really synonymous with the expansion of the Turkey-US relationship was this emphasis on roads and highways in place of railways. I wonder if you could open this up a bit. You know, why were highways seen as being so important and symbolic at this time?
Yeah, the highway initiative, a lot of the rationales that are given at the time have to do with them being seen as more efficient in, you know, ensuring door-to-door delivery of things, farm-to-market transportation. So they seem to kind of provide an infrastructure for this agricultural-based development program that is increasingly replacing railroad-led industrialization policies of the 1930s and early part of the 1940s. And so I talk about how kind of highways become this site where ideas about modernization also converge at a number of scales. So on the one hand, it has to do with kind of measuring or directing Turkey's post-war economy, debates about public sector versus private sector developmentalism. So who should be responsible for paving the new roads? Should private contractors be involved? Should American contractors be involved? Who should hold the new highway building equipment? And ultimately, after a series of fights between American agencies, between the European Cooperation Administration, which is responsible for allocating Marshall Plan funds, versus the American Bureau of Public Roads, which is responsible for transferring expertise and technical skills to the Turkish highway engineers, they end up with a kind of a compromise, which is that certain aspects of the highway program actually are going to be done through public channels. So it becomes this kind of transitionary site of these debates about the direction of the economy. But there are, I think, also in the rhetorics that are used by both the experts and the policymakers and intellectuals during this period, there are also, again, continuities with the previous railway building programs, which were also in the 30s justified on the basis of political and economic integration. And a very similar language is used. Another language that is repeated in the case of the railways and the highways, I think, is this discourse about civilizational difference. And so just like railways before them, highways also become justified as a way of reaching these territorial outposts, especially Kurdish populated areas, which are otherwise seen as difficult to integrate into the nation. And so along with the redirection of the economy, there are also these national integrationist ideas that are being worked out on highways. But at the same time, of course, the relationship between Turkey and the United States is also taking new directions. The conversations that they are having are not just this bickering about how much machinery to bring and how much experts, how much civil American engineers should be paid in Turkey, but also about producing civil engineers and peasants who are seen as kind of the primary recipients of these new highway projects, producing them as particular subjects who are supposed to cultivate new ideas about future orientation and rationality and saving and time management via the building and kind of enjoyment of highways. So it's a very kind of a complex, rich site where ideas about modernization at multiple levels come together.
Now, the book is called Hotels and Highways. Obviously, we talked about highways there. A large section of the book is devoted to hotels, and specifically the Hilton Hotel in Istanbul, which is really a symbol of this era and of the US-Turkey Cold War alliance more broadly. The Hilton Hotel in Istanbul, it's still standing today. It's very visible and distinctive, not far from Taksim Square. It's basically this huge kind of rectangular box in a kind of modernist style. And it's a very symbolic building because it was opened in 1955, and it very very consciously had a role in the civil or cultural front of the Cold War. So Hilton franchises were opened in Tel Aviv, Cairo, Athens, elsewhere, and also, of course, in Istanbul. And the one in Istanbul was funded by state institutions in both Turkey and the US. And from the word go, it was really deliberately part of this Cold War cultural strategy. Just talk about why you wanted to reserve so much space in the book to the Hilton. Why is the Hilton in Istanbul so important?
The beginning parts of the book, I talk about social scientists who are turning to Turkey as a possible site of experimentation and as a laboratory almost of applying these novel ideas about modernity. And what struck me about, for instance, Konrad Hilton's own language that he used in Hilton publications or propaganda material was how he used a very, very similar language of he thought about his hotels as, again, a laboratory where people in Cairo, people in Tel Aviv, people in Istanbul could come and experience for themselves what American modernity looked like. And in that era, it meant for him, you know, tennis courts and milkshakes and even architecturally, right, putting on display this international style that was being perfected also in corporate architecture in major American cities. And because of Hilton's own description of his own projects and kind of himself as a good cold warrior, it seemed like symbolically, but also as a material site, again, this hotel was a very, very important kind of tool of cultural diplomacy. And while reading about this period, I saw mentions of the Hilton as the central symbol of the spread of American modernization to places like Turkey, especially by architectural historians' accounts. And so I became also interested in how, beyond the symbolism of the building itself, how Turkish policymakers understood it, how they justified it to their domestic audiences. For instance, there was a big controversy for providing the space for the hotel because it ended up expropriating what was supposed to be a public park. But of course, that public park itself had been partly based on, we know now, on lands that had once belonged to Armenian cemetery. And so I think for me, while the Hilton kind of at first glance seems like this easy symbol of the propagation of an American modernism during the Cold War, actually when you look closer to it, several motivations and also several exclusions that went alongside the spread of this modernization, which had to do with campaigns against internal others. So for instance, 1955, when Hilton is being raised, it's also the year of the anti-Greek pogroms in Istanbul. And yet here's a hotel that might otherwise be perceived as foreign capital, it remains untouched. So what does it mean in terms of kind of revealing, again, the contradictions of the period in terms of the enthusiasm for foreign private capital versus the dispossession of internal minority communities, be it Greeks or Armenians and Jews and so on and so forth, which is so central to the history of modern Turkey, basically.
At one point, you quote a speech delivered by Konrad Hilton from the 1950s where he presents what the philosophy behind these hotels was. It's unbelievably sincere. I was amazed when I read it. I'm going to quote it here. He said, quote, "We are all innkeepers, you and I, innkeepers of the most sturdy and hospitable inn ever erected for a human guest, the United States of America. A world-famous hostess stands at the door, her torch held high to light the way for seekers of freedom and opportunity. Our inn has sheltered the hungry and homeless, princes and potentates, and the victims of religious purges and persecutions. Each guest on arrival is given a complimentary gift, the gift of individual freedom. And the price? Guests pay as they stay, they work for their keep, and are expected to become self-sustaining. They keep the inn clean, they defend it, and above all, they learn to love it." It's remarkably cheesy stuff. I don't know, I was laughing as I read it, but it kind of gets to the heart of what the image of the Hilton was and how it was promoted, I suppose.
And I think even there, you know, there's this simultaneous, he's upholding this American hospitality, the door is open, but there's something about doing the work, doing a certain amount of work to earn the privilege of being a guest. And I think in terms of the kinds of disciplining that went alongside a lot of these projects, right, in order to keep being a beneficiary of programs like the Marshall Plan, in order to be able to entice a big, huge project at the time, like the Hilton, host countries, also also had to behave in certain ways. And so, again, I think part of what these ideas about modernization did, in addition to, again, to larger questions about a shift to capitalist agriculturalist production, it was also at the level of subjecthood. And so it was a question of kind of making sure that by creating the material sites like the Hilton or the highways, you were also cultivating certain traits like a proclivity for mobility, a proclivity for hospitality, an ability to be a good, proper guest and to, again, be a good ally, to be a good recipient of aid, not ask too many questions. And certainly that also entailed doing things like, at the time, imprisoning leftists or when something like the anti-Greek pogroms happened, basically make up lies about how it was the communists that were responsible for such a thing and, you know, making sure that basically a series of center-right governments were in power, which was also a big part of what it took to behave as good allies, good guests, but also good hosts during this Cold War period.
Now, the book also reminds us of how this idea of the US looking at Turkey as a model goes back a long way. It actually dates back to the start of the US-Turkey relationship at the start of the Cold War, this era that you look at in the book. And back then, Turkey was seen as a kind of non-communist model for various other countries, both in the Middle East and elsewhere. And of course, in subsequent decades, Turkey was repeatedly reinterpreted in different contexts and circumstances by the US as a model for other countries. Most recently, of course, in the 2000s and 2010s, before things went sour recently, many US officials saw Turkey as a kind of moderate Muslim democracy that could be a shining example or model for other countries in the Middle East. But as you make the point in the book, this idea of Turkey as a model really dates back to the 1950s. Could you just talk about what was behind this initial presentation of Turkey as a model back then?
I mean, it came from a series of things. Modernization theorists' interest in explaining political development as best carried out by responsible elites rather than in response to anything that the masses might want. And so people like Denver Rostow, who I talk about at length in the first chapter of the book, were very involved in, I think, crafting this idea of the Turkish model of modernization. And a lot of the history that they gave was based on a certain kind of romanticized history of early Republican era reforms, which were presented as one reason why Turkey was years ahead of its Middle Eastern neighbors and should be upheld as a model that they could replicate or emulate. And so I guess it's kind of an infatuation that starts with Turkey scholars who start giving these kind of clean stories about Turkey's history of reforms and who have not at all that much to say about either the authoritarian nature of those reforms or Turkey's persecution of its minorities or leftists or later on the coups that actually ended up interfering with its kind of democratic trajectory. And what struck me in the late 2000 period was, again, the reemergence of that trope of Turkey as the good neoliberal moderate democracy in ways that suggested an utter lack of reflexivity about these histories of the previous eras when Turkey was once again presented as a model, although problematically then as well.
And thinking about this question of Turkey as a model, you quote U.S. or then U.S. Ambassador George McGee talking to Turkish President Celal Bayar at the time in 1952. He's writing somewhere and he says, quote, "I suggested to the president that Turkey might well, in her own interest, pursue such a good neighbor policy in the Middle East. Turkey was the natural leader of the Middle East because of her historical position, military strength, political stability, economic development and membership in NATO." It's quite eye-opening stuff and surprising when you read it, you know, 70 years on.
Yeah, at the time, there was an understanding among people like McGee, who was also a figure, you know, who would participate in things like Council on Foreign Relations meetings. So he would be talking to social scientists. He would be talking to like oilmen like Max Thornburg, who at the time was also very influential, who was at one point Adnan Menderes's economic advisor. But there was a kind of sense, I think, that in its earlier westernization project that he would have to persuade Bayar to take on a leadership role, which was also encouraged through a series of things like regional pacts, like the Baghdad Pact, which later became CENTO, and then a series of universal universities or administrative centers that were founded in Ankara, right? The creation of the Middle East Technical University dates to this time, centers for public administration, which would have Middle East in their title, and which all had this kind of idea of attracting students, young administrators, and so on and so forth from neighboring countries. None of them really worked in the ways that, the American and the Turkish experts imagined. I don't think Turkey ended up becoming a regional template in any way. And certainly ideologically, it was never able to present a viable alternative to pan-Arabism or anything like that. But it is interesting that this aspiration to a regional leadership being a model was something that had to be encouraged by American policymakers. And yet it's something that we kind of take for granted today, I guess, given AKP aspirations as a regional leader for quite a few years now.
And it really was echoed, you know, in the 2000s. You had almost verbatim the same kind of language being used. Of course, now the book appears at a time of great turbulence in the relationship between Ankara and Washington. I don't think we need to go through the reasons why. Everybody knows the catalogue of grievances that are built up on both sides. So I guess, you know, it's quite a fortunate coincidence, really, that your book comes out at a time when the Turkey-US relationship is being re-examined once again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the publication was before the recent Minute debates, so it's not something that I get to revisit in the conclusion, and I just end with that 2008-2010 moment with the resurgence of the Turkey model during the Arab uprisings, and not necessarily this recent worsening of relations with the U.S., but hopefully excavating some of the history of during these Cold War years would hopefully help us make better sense of what's going on today.
That was Begum Adalet. Many thanks to her. Remember to consider signing up as a Turkey Book Talk member. And also remember that from now on, there's a new addition to the membership system, the archive of 231 reviews that I wrote over 5 years until this past summer for the Hurriyet Daily News. The reviews cover subjects ranging from Turkish and international fiction and poetry to history, journalism, politics, the Middle East and Europe. And because they no longer exist online, from now on, a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. Of course, members also get access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview as it's published, as well as transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 70 conversations so far. Members are also able to get a hefty 30% discount on a catalogue of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, and if you're personally not sure, then why not consider signing up as a gift for a friend or colleague who may be interested. Also, please do rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks. Thank you very much for listening. Bütün dünyayı gezdim dolaştım, anladım ki...